Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Daniel Wolfson, executive vice president of the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at a heart-powered pacemaker that could eliminate the need for battery packs. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Prosthetics have achieved something of a high art form in this country, with technologic advances that make them more lifelike than ever. But the typical prosthetic device in America costs about $10,000. In countries like Thailand, where the average salary is about $2 a day, that cost is simply prohibitive for the thousands of amputees there. Dr. Tirchai Jivakate, who did his residency at Northwestern University, knew that he had to tackle three problems to make limbs available to those in poor and remote areas. He needed low-cost materials, he needed trained technicians to make and fit the devices, and he had to get the prosthetics to the amputees. His solutions? First, he devised a method to use recycled plastic from items as simple as used yogurt containers in place of the expensive titanium and created a lightweight, highly efficient limb adaptable to the physical rural Thai lifestyle. He managed to design high-quality prosthetics for about $100 apiece, and he launched the Prosthesis Foundation of Thailand. Dr. Jivakate trained amputees who were already using the comfortable, lightweight artificial limbs to become the next generation of fitting technicians for new patients, thus giving the new amputees the support of people who've been there, and at the same time creating jobs for these technicians. He also realized that he had to bring the clinic to the patients, and he launched a fleet of mobile units that go out into the remote countryside to find those in need. Since the foundation began, 25,000 amputees have received affordable, comfortable, working prosthetics. The Prosthesis Foundation of Thailand has turned discarded waste into wealth at a tiny fraction of the typical cost. Now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with Daniel Wolfson, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the American Board of Internal Medicine. That's the ABIM Foundation. The foundation, in conjunction with Consumer Reports, recently announced the launch of the Choosing Wisely campaign to reduce the overuse of unnecessary medical tests, which waste limited healthcare resources and drive up healthcare costs in this country. Mr. Wolfson, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Daniel, your organization has long been committed to catalyzing improvements in healthcare by advancing medical professionalism, and you recently announced Choosing Wisely campaign, which has enlisted 9 leading medical societies to identify 5 tests each that are commonly used but often don't yield any benefits that justify the cost or the risk to the patients. We have the good fortune of working alongside Dr. Stephen Smith, who practices medicine at our community health center. He also serves on the ABIM Foundation board, and he spearheaded an initiative in 2009 called the National Physician Alliance Good Stewardship Project, which asked its members to identify 5 medical tests that could be greatly reduced. Tell us more about the mission of the American Board of Internal Medicine, the partners in the Choosing Wisely campaign, and your hopes and expectations for this initiative.
I work for the ABIM Foundation, which is different than the ABIM. American Board of Internal Medicine certifies physicians in internal medicine in 17 subspecialties. And the ABIM Foundation, in coordination with ABIM, advances professionalism, convenes leaders together, does things like this campaign, conducts research, all in the notion of how intrinsic motivation, professionalism, has an important role in improving quality. The physician charter spells out 3 principles and 10 commitments. One of them is social justice. One of them is the primacy of the patient. One of our commitments was for physicians to be good stewards of limited resources. And that's been a real challenge for physicians to think about putting their patients first and then thinking about resources. How do they hold what's seemingly a paradox? And that was one of the reasons we were so interested in addressing the stewardship of limited resources. We also think that it's an important issue given healthcare reform and given the unsustainable economic trends in medicine healthcare costs.
Daniel, your consortium of 9 medical societies, which represent, I understand, about 375,000 member physicians, so a very significant group, identified 45 commonly ordered tests that were deemed overused. And these are tests that clinicians and patients might want to think twice about. Now, I understand you've listed them all on your website, choosewisely.org. But talk to us about some of the most prevalent examples of these overused tests and what they cost all of us, both in financial resources, but also risk. Talk to us about that.
Okay, well, let me first say that the list that came out was not a never-to-do list. We want to have informed conversations with patients and physicians. And so that's why we partnered with Consumer Reports to provide easy-to-use information for patients to have these conversations. But sometimes they're quite appropriate and usually not. So these 9 have come up with such things as a CT or an MRI after fainting, EKG or stress test at an annual checkup, antibiotics for acute sinusitis. These are some of the examples. Now, I'm not a doctor, but let me give you an example. I went to a physician, my primary care physician, and I went in for a cold, and I thought I actually had SARS. I was in China. And he really prodded me on and said, you know, you need an EKG. And I, in fact, did. I wish I had a piece of paper from Consumer Reports telling me that that was not a good thing. I also wanted to talk about Steve Smith, if I could.
Oh, we'd love to hear about Steve.
Well, Steve is a real hero in my book because he was the one that applied for a grant from us suggesting that the National Physician Alliance should do this in internal medicine, family medicine, and in pediatrics. And a small group representing about 36,000 physicians, but very forward-thinking, came up with this list, and it was called the Good Stewardship Project. They put that into the Journal of Archives of Internal Medicine, written by Steve Smith. In fact, Steve Smith has gotten another grant from us, and he's going to do tapes on how to talk to patients, how physicians should talk about patients about these kinds of things. Because oftentimes, you know, sometimes it's the physician recommending it, and sometimes the patient has heard about it on TV or radio, and the physician's in an awkward spot to say, listen, you really don't need that. I'm a father, and when I took my son with his cold, I was thinking, okay, antibiotics. Now I think that we're a little bit smarter, but we also need physicians to have the skill to provide the security, to provide alternative courses of treatment if that doesn't work. And Steve is working on that as well. So Steve gets a lot of credit for what we've done. We spread it to 9 major specialty societies who have 374,000 physicians, and we're also adding on 8 other more and even more to come.
Well, that's a great shout out for him. I want to pull the thread a little on that, Daniel, because patients come into their provider offices with, as you were saying, pre-established ideas about what tests they should receive. And now your partnership with Consumer Reports may address some of these, and providers need to focus in on a patient-centered care, which may address a little more of these. And you have your website, choosingwisely.org, where patients and providers can both go to and get information. Will Consumer Reports or any of the medical journals be coming out with additional reports or information about these recommendations? And what's the overall plan on patient education? I think that's at the heart of what you were talking about. And how do you see these resources working together?
So let me go on the physician side for a moment. The American Society of Clinical Oncology has a journal article in clinical oncology. All the specialty societies are having communications with their members about this. On the patient side, what we're hoping for is this translation of the recommendations into consumer-friendly language, and practicing physicians hopefully will have these in their offices to give to patients when such a conversation comes up. Mm-hmm. But Consumer Reports also has, within its arsenal, Consumer Reports, and we've also linked with AARP and 8 other consumer organizations, and we want the message, the conversation, and that information to go through those channels. And I'm a person of great hope that the conversation has changed about talking about resource use. It's joint shared responsibility of both patients and physicians. We don't want to blame the physicians. We don't want to blame the patients. Let's just have a rational conversation about use. Give me everything I need, nothing more, nothing less.
Well, Daniel, I think you hit the nail on the head with that, and it seems to me that your campaign, Choose Wisely, is a wonderful phrase that certainly gets at the heart of respecting the professional decision-making. And really, I think your emphasis on social justice is one of the fundamentals of the foundation, and we haven't used the word rationing, but that certainly is something we learned a big lesson on during the health reform debates when we spoke about end-of-life care and how quickly well-intended measures could be taken out of context. Tell me a little more about this campaign for consumers. You mentioned perhaps Dr. Smith and others making tapes and really blocking at the outset, I think, the conversation turning to rationing and instead making it about quality and about informed decision making. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think you're right on. You're right on target. You know, rationing is when you're not given something that's beneficial, and this campaign is about giving you things that are not necessary and potentially harmful. The consumers, I believe, will be better informed and there'll be better skills by the physicians about how to have this conversation, how to provide security to the patient. So I think both are going to be armed appropriately. Both are going to be involved in an informed decision and both empowered. This campaign is not about the payers, the insurers, or the government for that matter. This is about patients and consumers getting together to talk about what kind of healthcare system they would want. And to get rid of the hysteria about death panels. Those are more difficult conversations, but right now we're just talking about waste. And I heard a physician, Patty Gabo, she's a physician in charge of Denver Health.
Oh, yeah, we know her well.
And she said at a recent presentation, she was given an award by NCQA, waste is disrespectful to my employees and my patients. Why would anybody want to produce something that had no value to a patient? And how do they feel when they're giving something that is wasteful? I think people are misaligned. And when people are misaligned, they don't act in a way that's professional or satisfying to themselves. And I think as we improve care, care will be better for patients and care will be better for physicians to work in those environments. This ray of hope of this campaign and this optimism, I think, has really reached a strong chord. I think that there's three things that have made the campaign take off like it has. One was the right messenger. Physicians, leaders, talking about the best care. The message being about quality and safety and doing no harm and optimum, appropriate care and not wasteful. And three, the actions are relatively straightforward. There are certain things. We didn't name 300. We named 5 for each specialty, so the action is good. And the fourth thing, I think, is that we've been respectful of both physicians and patients in this. And we're not in this for the short term. We see this as a long campaign. We want to welcome people into this campaign. People can join this campaign. People can begin to ask the questions they need to ask. And we would love to hear their stories, of course, because we want to spread the word about those successful conversations or how somebody diverted a bad test. But again, there are exceptions. Doctors are needed because they need to recognize exceptions. So we're really excited about this campaign, and we had a wonderful New York Times editorial, which I think put us even more on the map.
We're speaking today with Daniel Wolfson, Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation, whose mission is to increase medical professionalism, reduce the waste of limited health resources, and promote the advancement of team-based care in the 21st century. Daniel, for years, various groups have sought ways to find to reduce expenses and improve health outcomes through recommending changes to care being provided. Talk to us a little bit about the evidence-based research that's going on or you hope that will go on around the recommendations, these clinical decision recommendations to reduce unnecessary testing and the effect they're having on expenses and outcomes.
Well, you know, I think clinical guidelines have been the hallmark of specialty societies for some time now. And they really advance the quality of care, and also measures have been built around them. I think what we're trying to do is a kind of a different translation from, you know, the science to the practice. So a clinical guideline is put out, it's put in a clinical journal, and it's a hope that people will take that those guidelines up and practice those. So I think what we're trying to think about are what are some creative ways of taking all that knowledge, and there is much, much more clinical information that's just so hard to keep up. And there's a whole set of habits and trainings that go on involving physicians and patterns of practice. So is this campaign maybe a different way of thinking about that translation of knowledge into practice? And that's what we're going to explore over the years to come, about how to translate that knowledge, those guidelines, into practice. This notion of that it takes 17 years for new knowledge to be converted into practice. Have you ever heard that before?
Yes, and I'm hoping that soon we're no longer going to have to say that. There's just no excuse for it anymore.
To bedside.
But it has a tremendous complex nature about it. And so I'm hoping in the future we're going to test this translation, new ways of thinking about translation. And this campaign maybe is the tip of the iceberg. But I'm hoping that there's a better conversation. I'll give you two examples of two conversations that I've heard already. One is a group practice got together and said, what are we going to do with these recommendations? You know, are we going to abide by them? What do we think about them? Do we do them? That was an excellent conversation for a group of physicians to have. The other one was a prestigious academic medical center, and the person that is the associate dean said that on any grand rounds, we're going to ask them not to leave the building without telling us what a choosing wisely item is. So already these kind of conversations are permeating, but I think this is way beyond just this foundation. I think this has hit a positive chord, and you know, no politics as usual.
And Daniel, I can tell you here in Connecticut around tables of primary care coalitions that I sit at, it is already being discussed, and I think that would be true even if Dr. Smith wasn't one of the people often at those tables. But let me ask you this. Certainly we all recognize we're living in a great and exciting time of transformation in healthcare, and choosing wisely is one of many initiatives of the foundation, and others have focused on certainly the very important area of medical education and training reform, on payment reform, team-based care, patient-centered care, care coordination. Tell us how these initiatives relate to one another, and particularly how do they relate to choosing the Choose Wisely initiative?
That's a good question. The issue that we've been that runs throughout our organization has been about relationships, trusting relationships among physicians. We've also focused very much recently on primary care, and that when we talk about teamwork, that was around primary care, care coordination, payment reform. Two things I think have to happen to really get a handle around cost. One is the reimbursement system has to be addressed. That is not a part of this campaign, but it certainly has to be addressed, and payment is so crucial. But primary care, having a vitality within primary care, having the best medical students and residents be attracted to primary care is essential to excellent care and sustainable economically. Other countries have higher percentages of primary care physicians than we do, and their costs are lower, and their outcomes are better, and their satisfaction of patients and physicians are better.
I want to ask you a follow-up on that, though. How do you see your recommendations being received internationally, and are there ideas from other countries that you're looking to incorporate into your recommendations, or international organizations you're considering partnering with?
We don't have any, aim to do that, not at this moment at least. You know, we're a fairly, small organization, and we try to be a catalyst. If somebody would have come across the pond and asked us what we did, we would certainly try to help them start their own kind of initiative around this.
Well, in the spirit of innovation, Daniel, we like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation that our listeners at Conversation should be keeping an eye on?
Oh, boy, that's a long conversation. I see a lot of innovative practices that are looking at the patient well-being and the physician well-being, that are providing care that's coordinated, and that it's a joy for patients to enter and physicians to enter. And there's pockets of these innovations. And I think the government under the Affordable Care Act is setting up some excellent demonstrations that could become reality around accountable care organizations, patient-centered medical homes, bundling. And I think all those new models, particularly bundling of services, are going to require new kind of conversations, new trusting relationships. And I think that's the core of professionalism, in my estimation, those trusting relationships between patients and physicians, between physicians and nurses. And that's what's going to be needed. And I think that that will be the biggest innovation that we see going forward and the most needed. But there's a population that is poor and vulnerable in many ways. There's great disparities, and we need to address those in major, major ways. But if we have an overcrowded system, and I mean where there's high volume, the outcomes are worse, satisfaction is worse, the access is worse, and the outcomes, the health of the people are worse. So we've just got to get a handle on this, and I think that our part of our campaign is about this. If we reduce unnecessary care, we'll have the capacity to deliver what is needed in a timely way and in a quality way.
We've been speaking today with Daniel Wilson, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the ABIM Foundation. The foundation, in conjunction with Consumer Reports, recently announced the launch of their Choosing Wisely campaign to reduce the overuse of unnecessary medical tests, which waste limited healthcare resources and drive up healthcare costs in this country. You can find a link to their recommendations at their website, choosingwisely.org. Mr. Wilson, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. It was a real honor and privilege to be with you today.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with his Tech Report. Mechanical engineer Amin Karmani has taken his fascination with improving power generation for unmanned airplanes, hopefully soon into the chest cavities of people. Karmani and colleague Daniel Inman at the University of Michigan observed how they could harvest electricity from simple variations made by wind against plane wings, a relatively new field called energy harvesting. They thought, how could it be applied to human use? The answer? To power pacemakers and internal defibrillators, utilizing the power of the person's own heart, providing a lifelong power supply for implanted devices. Karmani says recent technological breakthroughs have made it so that a relatively small amount of vibration will generate enough electricity to keep the devices running indefinitely. The current problem, implanted battery packs to run those devices need to be replaced every 5 to 10 years. And say for a child who's had open heart surgery, that's a lifetime of multiple surgeries.
The patient has to go through another surgery in like 4 to 7 years, more or less, just to change the battery.
So he took his knowledge of energy harvesting in the aerospace arena and applied it to developing a device that could harvest the vibrations from the continually beating heart and convert it into more than enough electricity to power the pacemaker or implanted defibrillator. As few as 7 heartbeats a minute would be sufficient to produce the needed amount of power.
We can increase the amount of power and we can increase the bandwidth, which means that the device is not sensitive to heart rate. So these two pieces of technology which were developed in the past 2 or 3 years were the breakthrough that made the difference of being able to produce enough amount of power from heartbeat or not. And that's the reason that you see this right at this point of time.
Karmani and his team are partnering with the University of Michigan Medical Center to monitor heart vibrations more closely during open heart surgeries. They'll build a test prototype and be ready for testing in humans in the not-too-distant future. This aeronautics and engineering whiz could save a lot of patients a lot of heartache in the future. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this Tech Report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is a Connecting Our Communities initiative from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.